So we are in Genesis chapter 7, and we're going to be covering a larger section today. So if you can open up to Genesis 7, we're going to go through 8:19, and I would like to, whoa, nobody's making eye contact. Well, my wife is good. Okay, so Genesis 7. And Melody looked up so she can get Genesis 8. So, Jeannie, if you could get Genesis 7, and then we'll go into Genesis 8 through the 19th verse. So that will work. You're going to read Genesis 7. She's going to read Genesis 8 through verse 19.
Then the Lord said to Noah, "Go into the ark, you and all your household. For I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. Take with you seven pairs of all clean animals, the male and his mate, and a pair of animals that are not clean, the male and his mate, and seven pairs of birds of the heavens also, male and female, to keep their offspring alive on the face of all the earth. For in 7 days I will send rain on the earth 40 days and 40 nights, and every living thing that I have made I will blot out from the face of the ground." And Noah did all that the Lord had commanded him. Noah was 600 years old when the flood of waters came upon the earth. And Noah and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him went into the ark to escape the waters of the flood. Of clean animals and of animals that are not clean, and of birds and of everything that creeps on the ground. Two and two, male and female, went into the ark with God, as God, with Noah, as God had commanded Noah. And after 7 days, the waters of the flood came upon the earth. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on that day, all the fountains of the great deep burst forth, and the windows of the heaven were opened, and rain fell upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. On the very same day, Noah and his sons Shem and Ham and Japheth, and Noah's wives and the three wives of his sons with them entered the ark. They and every beast according to its kind, and all the livestock according to their kinds, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth according to its kind, and every bird according to its kind, every winged creature. They went into the ark with Noah, two and two of all flesh in which there was the breath of life. And those that entered, male and female of all flesh, went in as God had commanded him, and the Lord shut him in. The flood continued 40 days on the earth. The waters increased and bore up the ark, and it rose high above the earth. The waters prevailed and increased greatly on the earth, and the flood, and the ark floated on the face of the waters. And the waters prevailed so mightily on the earth that all the heaven, high mountains upon the whole heaven were covered. The waters prevailed above the mountains, covering them 15 cubits deep. And all flesh died that moved on the earth, birds, livestock, beasts, all swarming creatures that swarm on the earth, and all mankind. Everything on the dry land in whose nostrils was the breath of life died. He blotted out every living thing that was on the face of the earth, man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heavens. They were blotted out from the earth. Only Noah was left and those who were with him in the ark, and the waters prevailed on the earth 150 days.
Then God remembered Noah and every living thing, and all the animals that were with him in the ark. And God made a wind to pass over the earth, and the waters subsided. The fountains of the deep and the windows of heaven were also stopped, and the rain from heaven was restrained. And the waters receded continually from the earth. At the end of the 150 days, the waters. Then the ark rested in the seventh month, the 17th day of the month, on the mountains of Ararat. And the waters decreased continually until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the 1st day of the month, the tops of the mountains were seen. So it came to pass, at the end of 40 days, that Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made. Then he sent out a raven, which kept going to and fro to the until the waters had dried up from the earth. He also sent out from himself a dove to see if the waters had receded from the face of the ground. But the dove found a resting place for the silver he put. She returned into the ark. The waters were on the face of the whole earth. So he put out his hand to her and drew her into the ark to himself. And he waited yet another 7 days, and again he sent the dove out. Then the dove came to him in the evening, and behold, a freshly plucked olive leaf was in her mouth, and Noah knew that the waters had receded from her. So he waited yet another 7 days, and sent out the dove, which did not return again to him anymore. And it came to pass in the 601st year, in the first month, the first day of the month, that the waters were dried up, and Noah removed the covering of the ark, and indeed the surface of the ground was dry. And in the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth was dry. Then God spoke to Noah, saying, go out of the ark, you and your wife, and your sons' wives with you. Bring out with you every living thing, all flesh that is with you, birds and cattle, and every creeping thing that creeps on earth, so that they may abound on earth, and be fruitful and multiply on earth. So Noah went out, with his sons, and his wife, and his sons' wives with him. Now every animal, every creeping thing, every bird, and whatever creeps on earth, according to their families, went out of the earth.
Thank you. I like the dramatic reading. That's very good. I'll have to remember that for a future reference. Okay, Noah, we've looked at the creation, we've looked at the fall, and we've seen various characters so far. We've even looked at Noah himself before in the ramp up to the flood narrative as we're going into it now in Genesis 7. And we know that Noah found grace in the sight of the Lord. In spite of all that was going on around him, in spite of all of the evil, all of the destruction, all of the evil, sum total of the evil in men's hearts, and yet what Noah found was he found that unmerited favor. He found that grace of God that was given to him by God. Noah was a righteous man, as we've seen. He preached righteousness. He preached righteousness for hundreds of years. And with the destruction that was resident in the people, you would think that Noah would not have escaped. Noah was protected by God, and in spite of what was all going on around him, you know, we in our day and age, death threats, and no, I'm sure that there was much more that was that came against the people that came against Noah. There was no restraint, or you know, that very little restraint, and yet God preserved Noah, and we're going to see that as a common theme. In spite of what was going on around him, Noah was a man of great wealth. There's no way that he could have undertook what he did in building this massive structure, this huge ark, and all the wood and all of the preparation and the organization that it would have taken to be able to get the timbers where they needed to be able to cut them into the exact dimensions, to be able to exact out what he needed to do. This isn't something that he does by himself, or even he's doing it obviously with his sons, but there's nobody else to help him out. But that is interesting to note that he's a wealthy man. And again, the scripture has said in the past that he did all that God commanded him. He continued to do all that that God had commanded him here in Genesis 7, in verse 6. He did what the Lord told him to do, and that is the commendation of scripture. So, Noah is a righteous man. Why is Noah saved? Why is Noah selected? I know I'm breaking my normal lecture format. I'm asking a question that you guys can actually interact with and respond to. He found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Okay, we've gone over the Hebrews chapter. I feel like every week I'm going back to Hebrews 11. I love that chapter. What a great chapter. And yet it was by faith. Noah exercised faith, but Noah was given that faith from God. And he was the selected instrument to be able to save mankind. And God comes to him and tells him that there's evil on the face of the earth, and I'm going to destroy all of mankind, and yet I'm going to rescue you and your family. So that's a humbling task, and so he gives him the blueprint for making the ark, and so he makes the ark. Over hundreds of years, the fact that the ark is out there is preaching to the culture around him. The fact that, what's that you're doing up there, Noah? Well, it's an ark. What's an ark? It's something that goes in water and it floats. I'm not seeing anything around here. Where's the water going to come from? Trust me, it's going to come. And it's going to bring destruction. And everybody's going to die. And they laugh him off, you know. And yet, there's this constant preparation. There's even possibly, we can, I think, safely speculate that in the process of building this huge ark, he's seeing exactly the same thing. And he's listening to the culture around him as they accuse him. And so he's going to have to ask himself that same question. So we saw it last week that it was that Noah interacts with God. God comes to Noah seven times. Seven times specifically comes to him. We're going to see that God continues to give him that grace, that unmerited favor, and specifically in the revelation that he gives to him. And when he commands, then Noah will take his family into the ark. This ark is, Calvin likens it to a sepulcher. So what he's going to have to do is he's going to have to renounce everything. He's going to have to renounce all his great wealth. He's going to have to renounce his current lifestyle. He's going to have to renounce his mission of a sort. And he's going to have to obviously redefine what that mission is. As he and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives that the scripture repeat for us are brought into the ark, and then they're saved through that ark. God remembers Noah. It isn't like, oops, I forgot who this guy was, and now I'm being reminded of Noah again. No, God remembered Noah. God had that favor that he had already displayed towards Noah, and he remembered Noah. And this is important to show that relationship with God that Noah has. So I want to introduce the concept here of, this is what O. Palmer Robertson calls the covenant of preservation. So in this particular segment of redemptive history, we see that all of mankind, all of the creation is going to be destroyed, and that the creation is going to be saved through the ark, through Noah's ministry, and preserved in that ark. We go back to what God has already said back in Genesis 6:18, that he makes a covenant with Noah. And he makes an agreement, and this is initiated by God, and it's going to cost a lot, but this is something that he has done and that he continues to fulfill. And I want to connect the dots. I want to introduce the concept, because I'm going to be going over this extensively next week as we get into Genesis 9 and specifically what God says about the covenant. But the covenant is made with Noah. But the covenant is also made with families. He's making it with Noah and with his offspring. And so the covenant promises of God that there would be a redeemer to come, that there would be somebody who would crush the head of the serpent, is going to be preserved through Noah and through his lineage, through his offspring. So God is working through families, and that also is a common theme that we have seen in Genesis with the godly line and with the ungodly line, and the godly line being preserved and the covenant being made through that godly line. And just to go into outside of the section of scripture that we read, but into a little bit of what we're going to talk about next week, that through the covenant promises of God, through the flood, God will say, I'm not going to destroy mankind ever again by means of the flood. No more flood equals the preservation that God is providing in and through Noah, in through the ark. And the covenant of preservation, what a great title that O. Palmer Robertson has there in this particular segment of redemptive history. Okay, so the ark itself, we've also looked at the ark, we've looked at the dimensions, we've looked at the physicality of the ark itself, but judgment is what goes with the ark, right? The ark is a symbol of that judgment, and the ark then provides the salvation to the people of God so that they are rescued, they're taken out of this world, and the ark itself is that means by which the people of God are saved. Okay, it's an ark, it's an object, and yet there's typological significance here because this is also, the ark itself is a picture of Christ. The ark is that means, that tool, and God uses means, he uses tools, he uses people, as we have seen, to preserve the godly line. He also uses inanimate objects, and that's going to be that ark. He said that about Noah, that Noah is a righteous man. We know because of the Faith Hall of Fame that Noah by faith believed what God said about the destruction that was going to come. As a result of that faith, he built the ark, and then that righteousness is then demonstrated. The working out, as we've been studying in James, the working out of that that belief, that faith exercising itself and finding itself in the working out, that sanctification and the building of the ark. And the point that I've made before is that this is one human being, and one human being is the means that God is going to use to be able to save all of humanity. Okay, there again, Noah is a type of Christ, and Noah is, as we will see later on as we get into this, that Noah is not perfect. Noah does sin. Noah needs a Savior. Noah himself needs a Savior, even though God will use him as a means to salvation for the people of God, the subsequent people of God. Okay, and so by sevens, two by two, and Noah continues to, he chooses out the two by two in obedience to God. He chooses out seven. And what we have here is a picture also of he's going to be able to provide extra extra animals for the sacrifice, the clean animals. But they bring unclean animals into the ark as well. And so it isn't like some are excluded. God brings all of them onto the ark, but only some of them then will be dedicated for the sacrifices. But those sacrifices, God has already said, basically, to provide for those sacrifices. So, and Noah knows that. Okay, when you have seven animals, that means three pairs, one for the sacrifice. We've got an immediate pair for the sacrifice. And then as Noah and his family see that these couples end up doing what couples do and they end up procreating, then that will provide hope to God. And this is another point that Calvin makes, that in the fact that there is reproduction, in the fact that there is a continued line for the animals, then that will extrapolate to the people of God. That will be an encouragement to these people that are stuck on a boat for a very long period of time. And, yeah, sorry, I can't make that, any bigger. I tried to make that big, but, it's interesting also that even the birds are included. Birds can fly, but birds can't fly through, thunderstorms that keep on, going and, the intent of the whole ark, the intent of having all of these animals on the ark, obviously is to preserve what God has chosen, that out of all of the animals, two by two, he's going to preserve the animals that are going to then populate the earth. And obviously, if God's intent is to keep the animals alive, then he's also wanting to keep the human beings alive as well. They go into the ark, the ark, the flood. It's interesting to note that, wait a minute. There we go. Okay. I've said before, and I'm going to continue because that's how I've been instructed, and that's what we believe, that this is a historical event. This is what actually happened. And as my good wife said this morning, you can either believe God or you can believe the lie. You can believe what evolution says, that these happened by natural processes. You still have to answer lots of other questions under the evolutionary format. You have to answer the question of how did we get to this place where these laws just happen? Are they eternal in and of themselves? And so we go back to Occam's razor. The bottom line on Occam's razor is whatever is the simplest is normally the right answer because it involves the fewest number of assumptions. The reason it's called a razor is because it cuts out all of the other arguments. And that's normally the case. This is a philosophical argument, and we can debate the whys and wherefores of that one, and I'm sure that evolutionists would say there's more assumptions in the flood narrative, but we as good Reformed theologians, as good Christians would say, it's actually easier to believe that God is the God of all creation. It's easier to say that he is the one that takes care of those assumptions, if you will. And they would accuse us of non-intellectualism, and we would say that Occam's razor actually supports our argument. We go back to Genesis 6:5. Every inclination of the thoughts of their hearts was only evil continually. That's the starting point as we go into the flood narrative. It's interesting to note that virtually all of the cultures on the face of the earth have some sort of flood narrative. I find that just fascinating. Is this legend, myth, you know, that makes it into the history? We can say that of animistic type religions, but there would be lots of them in the Christian realm that would point back to the biblical narrative. We could say that the Hebrews and even the Muslim cultures would point back here, but outside of that, then there's still that resident flood narrative that makes it kind of permeates through all of culture. Now, you know, the modern scientist says that's just a myth, that's just a story, that's legend, but we say it's actual history, and we now go into what actually happened in the flood. So in Genesis 7, 11, and 12, then we see that God opened up the heavens. The heavens opened up, and the water descends, and how Morris explains this is some sort of vapor canopy that was around the earth that would allow the sun to come in, but would keep the climate of the earth variously, you know, kind of the same, whether you're in the far north or whether you're in the far south, you know, relatively speaking, that climate would be the same. We see that demonstrated if you go back into Genesis 1, what you see in verse 6, that let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters. When we covered this, I acknowledge that term waters is this indistinct sort of separation out of things of what's going to end up happening. That narrative continues, and God made the expanse and separated the waters above from the waters that are underneath. And we continue on, verse 9, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together in one place, and let the dry land appear. And then in verse 10, let the dry land be called earth, and the waters that are gathered together be called seas. So we have land and seas before, but now we've got that separation, and now you've got the water coming from above, and then you've got the water coming from underneath. That also that separation, there were rivers in that flowed out of Eden, the four rivers, and that is described in Genesis 2. So it's not like there wasn't water before. There was water, there was some understanding of that seas, but it isn't like that they needed to get anywhere, because everything, you know, would still have been provided for them largely with the way that plants reproduce and so forth, even on their own, even in the sweat of the brow. But when they go into the ark, I should have separated these, should have put these backwards. There we go. In Genesis 7:16, then what we see is that God is the one who shut them in. With all of the water that's going to, and all of the hydraulic force that water provides, and all of that pressure, you're going to have a pretty significant seal to be able to seal that. And again, this is the encouragement of God, that God was the one that closed the door on them. They go, God is the one who did this. We didn't just pull up the drawbridge and end up closing up the door. And now when it's leaking, you know, that water's coming in, then we get back to, how come you didn't make that? How come you didn't put more pitch there? God is the one who closed them in. So encouraging the people in the ark in very rough times. 40 days of floodwaters coming on the people of God. I like that, that picture. Remember that the ark is what? How long? 450 feet, 300 cubits, and that's a long boat. And that wave is, I don't know, you think that wave is just about as tall as that boat? I think that probably provides some picture of what is actually going on during the 40 days. As the waters continue to come down, and as the waters continue to bubble up, then you're going to have a huge amount of water. The mountains were probably not as tall as they are now. You don't have whatever 30,000 foot Mount Everest, probably because you didn't have necessarily that tectonic plate movement pushing those mountains up. And yet it says that the water covered the mountains up to 15 cubits above. That's 23.5 feet-ish. 23.5 feet of water above the highest mountain, you know, on the face of the earth. We get some picture that's just a lot of water. And now all of a sudden, continents can move, and tectonic plates can move, and they can start colliding. In addition to these tectonic plates that are moving and continents that are moving, and, you know, We talk about the Pacific Ring of Fire. When you start having continents starting to butt up against each other, then you start having earthquakes, you start having volcanoes, you start having all kind of cataclysmic type events happening. And so that's, we're not going to be any, this flood narrative is not excluding any of that. But in the process of this happening, day after day after day, the floodwaters come, and the boat once again is subject to another tidal wave as the tectonic plates are moving and pushing that water around. And they're going to go, we're going to die again, and we're going to die again. And yet, day by day, the Lord is sustaining them through 40 days and through another, through the rest of the time, through the rest of that year that they are in the ark. So even though it's going to be trying, even though they would have said that they're about ready to die, even though they would have definitely felt what Calvin was talking about, that they are dead, they're in a sepulcher, they're going into the water, and that they're not going to come out. So the fact that God sustains them through that time is, going to be an encouragement to them. So we ask a question, is God just to destroy all of his creation? There's a nice abrupt transition into me talking and you talking. Yes, Liz. Sure.
Okay. So the waters beneath, were those before they moved out of their of the place where God had them at creation? Were they keeping the tectonic plates from moving? Is that what you're implying?
I would think that if there weren't really tectonic plates at that point, I would think it'd be even like crusts before God broke it up.
I'm going to go with, here's what Morris said. I'm not going to answer your question directly, but be a good instructor. There were also waters within the crust of the earth held there by reservoirs, valves, governors, and conduits that God had put into place. I like that. I think of the cell, and I think of all of the things that the recent, things that we've found, that there's little pumps and little, things inside of the cell, that God would have placed those same sorts of things in the earth's crust. And I'm going to acknowledge, I'll defer to Henry, I'll defer to anybody that's probably to most of you guys in this room, because this is something that this is all the area of speculation. And to come up, a creation scientist can come up with, having studied geology, having studied these processes, can say this is possible. The whole canopy is one that I think generally speaking is known to you all, to us, but yet it isn't necessary that that be the way that God, preserved the earth before the flood, but it's a speculation. And what it is definite. We can say that there's just a lot of water, and that that water provides a lot of pressure. And even the shores, is this in the Psalms, that the shores provide pressure against the land that... that make it so that the, mountains don't go crashing into the sea. So that also is just fascinating to me. Certain biblical concepts that are very small, one statement, and yet there's a whole understanding that goes behind that. So, did I sufficiently dodge your question, Liz?
No, you didn't, actually. You raised possibilities in
what you did. Okay. Good.
Bill, I vote for you for president.
Nice. I don't want it. I do not want that. There's no way. Yeah. I have a friend who at work, he said, once you throw in your integrity, the rest is easy.
Just to get your question, then, Scott, just, so if someone were to deny that, they would have to have a standard by which they judge God's actions. So one question would be, what's the standard by which anyone can judge God's actions?
Okay. So much for that discussion. Perfect. No, I'm just kidding. That's awesome. That's exactly what. That's a great question, and a great statement. That what is the standard outside of God? Back to my wife's statement this morning. So, here's what Calvin said. How enormous the crimes of men by which God was induced to destroy the whole world, whereas on account of his great clemency, he would have spared his own workmanship had he seen that any milder remedy could have been effectually applied. Way to, you know, Calvin, taking all of the variables and putting it into a nice succinct statement that you see in here the beneficence, the kindness of God, and you also see that tension that there must be, you know, a resolution for this injustice, for the violence that is on the face of the earth, and very, very helpful. Okay, we go into now. They have to wait. They have to continue to wait. At the 150 days we have that the waters are starting to recede. It's still a big lake out there and or a big ocean. And finally, the waters recede to some point where Noah feels like he can send out a raven. And Henry Morris brings out the fact according to the text, the raven goes out and he kind of flits to and forth, back and forth, and that he stays out. So now, getting into the gruesome detail of what's going on here, what do ravens do? I don't know if they do this before the flood, but after the flood.
They're carrion birds.
They're carrion birds, okay? And what do dead bodies do when they die? At least for some period of time, they come to the top of the water and they float. And so that was Morris's speculation, that they've got a ready source of meals out there. The other possibility, another thing to note about ravens versus dove, who flies better? I mean, I like watching seagulls out in California. I like watching ravens fly. I love watching the Mississippi kites, even though they attack you. But I like watching falcons. I'm describing birds that eat carrion, and so they can hover, they can stay airborne a lot longer, they can thermal. They know about that. Where a dove is really kind of that short range dude, and the dove. So we end up at day 271. He goes out and he comes back. Then at day 278, he goes out and he brings back an olive branch. And this olive branch represents more of the low-lying vegetation that now something is starting to spring up, and brings that back. And then at day 285, the dove doesn't come back. And he goes out and he stays away. Noah's in the ark. Noah's staying in the ark. Noah's staying put. Noah said, God was the one who shut me in. God is the one who will bring me out. And at day 314, they take off the cover. We talked about the cover. We talked about that protection that it provides. But there's been sufficient number of days where it's not deluging anymore, and so the covering ends up coming off. We got to get rid of all of this dank and stinky air in here, but it's not until day 371 that Noah actually, that God calls Noah out of the ark, and that's when that happens. If you look at the narrative, it says in the second day of the month, when they went into the ark on the 17th day, and you go to the second month on the, what does it say? 27th day. That sounds like 375 days. But remember the Jewish calendar, the lunar calendar, and the differences there, in addition to some, imprecise maybe accounting of on the, on that side, on the, you know, the accuracy that they had would have been different. And it's also possible too, just to throw things out, that the way that they measured the earth and the spin of the earth, it's possible that the spin of the earth can actually slow down, speed up. I'm sure Henry could speak to that. Okay. Then, what do they see? I'm reminded at this point that Jeannie and I have been over to Europe and to see pictures after World War I, pictures after World War II. It looks like the surface of the moon. It's unbelievable, the level of destruction. You look out at Verdun and you see trees and you see forests and you see, you know, even the trenches are still there, but have been somewhat washed down and filled up. But it's still, at that time, the photos that they had are like the surface of the moon. That's going to be the kind of picture that they have, that they would see as they first come out. Huge, absolutely stark contrast to what they had before. And they're also going to have this huge variation in temperature, which actually ends up making it into an ice age. And that ice age and the increase of that ice age, we've got mammoths that, you know, were frozen, like all the stuff still in their stomach and so forth. So huge variation in temperature versus what happened before this time. And you're also going to get all of the catastrophes. You know, Dorian is minor in the scheme of what happened during the flood, but that also is going to have the ripple effects into the other acts of God, if you will, and worldly devastation that is going on and continues to go on. I'll just put those up. So that's going to be what they're seeing. They know that God has closed them in. They know that from the way that the animals have propagated, that there is hope. There is some degree of hope. God has sealed them in and protected them against the shouts of the people, at least initially, that were outside screaming, "Save us, save us." Maybe or maybe not. Maybe they just ran away from the ark. But now they're going to go into the new earth. God is going to make the covenant with Noah. Noah's going to sacrifice, and we're going to talk about that all next week. This is kind of a bump deal, kind of a lull. A low point in the narrative, but. The fall was pretty bad too, so it continues. Any thoughts or comments?
Is the between the animals and the birds, like one possible interpretation is three pairs, and then one extra. The other possible interpretation is seven pairs. Look at it, is that?
And the seven, the number of perfection. So. Yeah, good comment. Randy.
Well, I think really the sort of the underlying theme of all of this is sort of the unveiling of God's plan of redemption and how he was going. In other words, it's like God could have destroyed everything. He could have just left Noah, he could destroy it all and just start over, basically. But he didn't. So he kept the household of Noah, and then he kept the two animals. He didn't keep all the animals, but he had two of each kind. And so I think that you start seeing the work of redemption going on here, how God is dealing with creation now. Not as he did four chapters ago, but as he's moving forward with his his plan of redemption, that you know, that Noah alone, but yet he kept the household. So would we even see that theme going into the New Testament?
Right, right. Very good. That's very helpful. Nice to focus on that plan of redemption that God is continuing, and so that we don't lose sight, so that we don't lose heart. You know, yeah, very good.
And another thing, it's not just the clean owls. When it talks about clean owls and birds, some of the birds would have been clean, but others of them, you know, like the vulture or the owl. They wouldn't be considered clean, but they would have also had to sit in there. And Answer Genesis, you know, theory about this is because birds are so frequently used to spread plant life, seeds and all that type of stuff, that having a little boost to that area would boost the vegetation, which would then allow the animals.
Yeah. Other animals. Yeah, but good.
Why, if God's killing or destroying